You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK Quad Cities NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics podcast and show, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very honored today to have as my guest the governor of Iowa, Kim Reynolds. Governor Reynolds earlier this week gave her fourth condition of the state address, and she's graciously agreed to come on today and discuss it with us. Governor, thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, Robin, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it very much. It's an honor to be with you.
Well, there was 2020 was a year of upheaval, to say the least. And in the speech, you kind of let everybody use their own adjective to describe it. But as governor, as the chief executive of the state, and all the challenges you face, I see where you're putting a spin on it that it's going to change the way the state does business into the future. What are some of the permanent changes you see that are going to force the state to adapt, and how do you plan to do that?
Yeah, I think first of all, what a testament to the people of Iowa and their resiliency and just outright grit to be able to just move through the year that we had in 2020 between a derecho, civil unrest, a drought, and then, of course, COVID-19. It's been quite a year, and we just, at every turn and in every area of our state, from healthcare to truck drivers to store clerks to teachers and just across the board, Iowa just stepped up and helped each other and really leaned in to the year that we had. And it's amazing, and it's why we're in the position that we are, and it's why I have complete confidence that our state is in a strong position to really rebound and come back stronger than ever. I talked a little bit about, at the beginning, we really entered into the year in a good financial position, which was incredibly helpful when you take a look at what some of the other states are dealing with. We entered in with cash reserves full, an actual $305 million surplus, and I said it's a tribute to the resiliency of Iowans, conservative budgeting practices, a diverse economy by far that really allows us to weather some of these disasters and the pandemic. And then, honestly, the fact that we made the decision, and a lot of the reason behind that is because we feed, not only the country but the world. We were able to keep over 80% of our businesses open and our workforce working. So that really allowed us to absorb some of the economic impact of a COVID and be prepared to come back stronger than ever. And so I said, between how we learn, how we get health care, how we work, just all of that has been impacted. And I believe that if we tackle issues like broadband, child care, workforce training, affordable housing, that it really does set Iowa on a path to economic prosperity for years to come. So that was kind of the impetus. That's why I think one of my big initiatives and something I'm really going to be pushing for is creating universal broadband access. It impacts all of that. It impacts our competitiveness. It impacts the growth in our state, keeping young people in all parts of Iowa, and just how we continue to do business moving forward. So that was a big piece of of my program moving forward. And then the other areas that I just talked about really fold into that very nicely.
I noticed that you mentioned not only broadband expansion, but speed. And I think we lose track of that sometimes, where it's nice to have broadband, but the speed is everything, especially when later in the speech you talked about trying to bring more telemedicine into rural areas.
Yeah, it's key. And we want to make sure after we've gone through that we have health care and access to the best resources. But again, the latency is so important in the speeds. And I tell you, I talked about it in the speech. I don't know if you remember, but throughout the pandemic, it was stabilize, grow, and recovery was kind of my three-phased approach. And I put together the Economic Recovery Task Force, 15-member board, over 350 Iowans from every corner of this state was involved in these working groups. And so they made some really significant recommendations. And broadband, of course, was one of them. And what I did not realize this, I can't believe I didn't because I'm very competitive, but Iowa we are the second slowest internet speed in the country. We are only behind Alaska. Well, that is unacceptable. We have to do better. We have a third of our counties that are still in broadband deserts, which means they don't even have 25.3. So hopefully with some of the CARES funding that I have right now, we can really attack those areas, get them up to 25.3, which is the federal definition of broadband, but it is not sufficient for what we need to do moving forward. But if I can get them up to the 25.3, then I think it gives us a good foundation to build on. And, you know, I'm the matching grants are based on the speed that they're willing to, the companies are willing to invest in different areas of the state. So we'll see how that goes, but we have to, you know, we have to do better than what we're doing, and hopefully by putting significant funding into that, we'll be able to leverage millions of dollars of private sector funding, and we will have, I think, if we're able to do this, over the next 3 years, the biggest broadband build-out of any other state in the country. Because every state, every state is looking at this. Every governor is going to be asking for significant investment in broadband. And if we're already 45th with access and the second slowest, we're going to have to move or we're going to continue to be left behind. And that's the only way we're going to grow. I mean, that's, you know, we have state agencies now that are going to continue to, you know, allow their workforce to work from home if it works for them. And so that opens up state agency opportunities in communities all across Iowa. And so I think that's another opportunity for all sections of our state to grow and expand and receive some of the and see some of the economic prosperity that we're capable of.
Well, I live in a rural area across the river in Illinois, and I just had my first doctor's appointment online, and I can tell you, it's for everybody out there listening, maybe seniors or all that are a little concerned, it worked out fine. I don't think it's going to get rid of in-person health care, but I think it's kind of an intermediary step, but it depends on this type of service being available.
You are so, so right. And even with, you know, we don't have enough psychiatrists in the state, so even as we're working with our school districts, and especially after the year that we've had, to be able to utilize behavioral health services with online and it just is critical. So there's definitely a role for it for both.
And you want to link up this with what you call Center for Excellence, the rural healthcare doctors with specialists. Can you share a little bit more about that?
Yep. So again, we want to make sure that the team is in place, and what that allows you to do is to partner with some of the specialists at some of the larger facilities and help provide the resources and the expertise to make sure that we have, again, exceptional health care in every single corner of the state. And a lot of the different hospitals are talking about that. And so what I've allocated $1 million to help drive that innovation and that excellence and utilize of expertise in some of our rural communities. And so what that would do, I think, is at least fund at least two pilot centers of excellence. So I'm excited. We started talking about this last year, and we just, with the with COVID, we, you know, and with the suspended session, we had a hard time. We weren't able to really work through that. So it's something that our larger hospitals have been talking about. I think it's a tremendous opportunity for our rural hospitals to really provide that level of care that Iowans can count on, so that that it's in their community, so that it's, you know, they can receive it without driving miles and miles and miles to get the care that they need.
So the federal government is pushing out more rapidly vaccines out to the states, and the states are taking a prominent role in this and distributing it. I know that the rules changed a little bit there as far as a lot of different states are doing different things. How do you envision the prioritization of getting vaccine out in Iowa?
Yeah, so we're ready to move into 1B, and if they have open files, they'll have the ability to do that. We are we'll be changing and updating the shortage order tomorrow. A lot of our restriction right now is the number of doses that we're getting. We're like dead last in the number of doses that are coming in, and they said they're allocating them based on population, and it's not aligning up. But with the doses that we've had, I'm so proud of the team. You know, we started this during the holidays, and so it was a little bumpy because of that, but they've really kind of moved into, I think, operationalizing it and getting people vaccinated. So So we've received about just 199,000 doses, but of that, 122 is actually what the state has authority over. 77,000, or just a significant chunk of that, is going to our long-term care facilities, as it should. So that, but it's ran by the pharmacy federal partnership that the federal government put in place. And so out of the doses that we've received, we're probably about at 92% administered. So we're really doing well in getting them out. And if they can get us the additional doses, we'll be able to, you know, sooner rather than later, move into 1B and start to, and that really opens up the number of people that will be able to get the vaccine. So we've got an infrastructure in place. We're working with our local governments. We're working with our pharmacies and local pharmacies, too. So I think that's really going to help us administer it. So we're making sure that they have the capacity and just to be able to do it in a responsible manner, so we don't have people waiting in line. We can get them to sign up. We can get them the vaccine and not have any other issues from that. But we're really close to moving forward with that, too. But a lot of this is just going to be based on the doses that we get, the allocation that we get from the federal government. They are telling us that the supply will exceed the demand. We're not seeing that yet. So as soon as we see those numbers, we're gonna get it allocated and administered and get people that want it vaccinated.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Governor Kim Reynolds from the great state of Iowa. We've been talking about her condition of the state speech, which she gave earlier in the week, and touched on a lot of different topics. I want to focus on one, and that's schools. That's one that's kind of gotten a lot of visibility here, and I want to give you the opportunity to kind of focus in on what exactly you're proposing and how that'll work.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I want to, first of all, I think what's really important, especially as I did several education listening forums, we did it all online, with parents and students and teachers and administrators from all over the state. You know, I want to commend probably over 80%, if not higher than that, of our school districts have figured out a way to get the kids back in the classroom and to do it in a safe and a responsible manner. And I think we can all agree that's where they need to be because of just so many issues, reasons, whether it's social-emotional growth, whether it's getting the behavioral health services they need, making sure that they're learning in a safe environment, and that the level of curriculum and instruction we know is so much better when you're in class and in person. But to hear just the heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching stories of parents and some educators of what they're dealing with for not having the option to be 100% in the classroom, it's just time that we do something about that. And so I have a lot of support from the legislature to give our parents and our students both the option to go 100% online and the option to be 100% in the classroom. And it's parents that's ultimately making that choice. We have a lot of data, too, from schools that we're not seeing the spread in the classrooms. When they do have positive cases, for the most part, not always, but for the most part, it's from exposure outside of the school district. They're actually safer in the classroom. CDC just came out again this week stating that the kids should be in the classroom. They're not seeing the spread. So they're verifying that. They just dropped 3 more white papers that help support and back up. I think President-elect Biden has made the recommendation and his top 3 priorities to get kids in the classroom. So we're lucky. There's a lot of states the kids haven't been in. And for the parents and the students that I talk to, you know, they've not really had a significant, they haven't been in the classroom for over 11 months, and we're seeing failing grades. We're seeing our literacy scores drop. You know, so we're starting to see the impact of them not having the in-class instruction, and our kids can't wait any longer. We need to get that corrected. In addition to that, you know, we said it's not just about in and out of school. It's about kids because of some open enrollment requirements that if they're in a failing school, they don't have the option to move to another public school, and I don't believe that's right. Now, parents that have the financial means and the income to move or to, you know, select another choice in a school district that's not meeting the needs of the student, you know, that's not fair. That's not fair to everybody. And so what this does is it actually allows open enrollment regardless of income for all students. And I think that that's really important that we move forward with that, provide some other options for kids that need alternatives with charter schools. That's another public school option. It just gives schools a little bit more flexibility by reducing some of the regulatory burdens. They still have to meet certain criteria, but it really helps us provide alternatives for kids that are struggling. And then, of course, the Students First Scholarships, again, that is very narrow. It is just tied to failing schools. It has a cap of $3 million, but kids that don't have the income should still have the opportunity if they're at a failing school to have another option. So those are some of the things that we're looking at. Another thing we're looking at is right now we base the funding on an attendance that's taken once a year in October. There's some other states that have gone to daily attendance, and then twice a year they log that, and then the funding is based on the number of kids that are actually in the seat. And Missouri did this, and they saw their attendance go up and truancy go down, and they've had some really positive outcomes because of that. And then education is a priority. We're continuing to invest in that. In my budget, I recommend a 2.5% increase for both this year and next. So that they know that, you know, that's our objective moving forward. And then there's a tremendous amount of federal dollars that are coming into our states. I think it's about $345 million to help them address with some of the issues of COVID, help them with testing, help them with mitigation efforts, so that they can make sure that we have safe classrooms and we're opening up safe and responsible.
So on the first item initiative you talked about, where the parents can I assume how this works, the parents in a school district can get together and vote to reopen. Are there assurances to the teachers if the teachers are sitting there listening to this and are concerned about possibly contracting COVID, even though it's less likely? But are they going to have the equipment there and masks, things like that?
Yep, and that's what the school districts that have opened responsibly are. You know, they're in 1B, so they can, you know, we're so close to moving into that, so they'll be able to get the vaccine. That's what some of the CARES funding, I mean, these schools are, you know, and they are, this is the second round of funding that they've received in addition to some gear funding, and so that we don't want that to be an issue. We said from the beginning, too, you know, we provided PPE for all the school districts, and we have it available. We said, you know, you just have to let us know if you need it, if you're not able to meet the needs. So that is there. You know, we have a vaccine. That's going to be there. And if they have underlying conditions, they can work with their school district. So there still are kids that, parents that, same thing, they have someone at home or a child has underlying conditions. So 100% online is still an option. So there's opportunities to potentially work with your, you know, the educators in your district to see if you can't provide them the flexibility based on that too. But, you know, just like they're an essential workforce, just like we have had, our nurses and doctors have showed up every day to be online. The CNAs who are in our long-term care facility, taking care of our loved ones, our truck drivers, our law enforcement, all of us, you know, it's hard. We just have to take the precautions that we can and do everything we can to keep everybody safe. But, you know, when you're, it's just part of being an essential workforce, too.
I remember talking to you a couple of years ago on this show when I believe you had first proposed this initiative, Future Ready Iowa, education and training. I'm sure last year progress might have been a little bit halting, but I know you referenced it again this year. Can you kind of give an update on where that's at?
Yeah, we're moving forward, and actually they've seen some really good upticks, so I'm really excited about that. And I also mentioned in the speech, you know, we're seeing a familiar problem where we have jobs looking for people, and so what an amazing opportunity for Iowans. So we put another $10 million in the Future Ready Iowa Last Dollar Scholars, and that's for adults or high school students that want to retrain or get a certification, registered apprenticeship program, two-year degree. That'll make the total allocation at $23 million, and we've had over 13,000 Iowans that have had the opportunity to take care of that. And we're getting these statistics. We, early on, when they were able to present the numbers to me, the completion rates were in the 90th percentile. So it was like they had got a job, they had completed, So it is working, and we've got some great metrics that we'll be able to share with Iowans, and so we're going to continue to build that out. I ask also, work-based learning is another amazing opportunity for our kids that are in school to kind of test run careers. That real-world experience engages a lot of students that just, you know, sitting there being lectured to, it just doesn't work for them. And like I said, it helps them prepare for a career that they really are passionate about. And we've got a lot of schools that are offering that, but not all of them. And I said, you know, every high school student should be able to have the opportunity to participate in a work-based learning experience by 2024. And so I put some additional funding to help make that happen. And literally, we should move that down. So we should be starting that with kids in middle school. I mean, there are ways that we can even take it down to elementary. But for sure, as they move into high school and they're starting to think about what's next, the more we can provide our young people with opportunities like that, you know, they might not need a four-year degree. They might be able to start their registered apprenticeship program and move from high school right into a job and make, you know, $50,000 while they're in high school. So there's just a lot of opportunities for us to build that out and provide Iowans with options.
There seem, to me, opportunities also to encourage more young people to get into small business. And in a lot of places, we just don't teach that very well. But one thing I've read a lot about, and I saw you referenced it in your speech as well, is licensing reform, where sometimes these rules kind of get in the way a little bit of people going into occupations.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think it's a quarter of our workforce requires some kind of licensing, and we lead the country, and that is not an area we want to lead in. And with the licensure reform that we passed at the end of last year, you know, it recognizes work experience. It makes us the most, we have the best reciprocity. I was trying to think of it. Reciprocity. Sorry, I couldn't think of the word. than any other state in the country. And so we're really leading. There's only about three states that have passed occupational licensing reform like we have. And it removes barriers and it helps people move into the workforce. And it says to the country, Iowa is open for business. If you're working in another state and you have a state license there, you're in good standing and it mirrors what we do here in the state, you don't have to come back in and take additional training and pay it, you know, additional fees. That we want you here. We have job openings ready. Come be a part of our great state. So I think the other thing that I did mention that the next step is to continue to review not only the licensing that we have in place, but just the boards and commissions also, and make sure they're doing what they were intended to do, if we even need them, if there's other ways that we can make Iowa more competitive, but most importantly, remove barriers to Iowans trying to get a great job in a responsible way.
We've got about 3-4 minutes left. I want to close out, and you gave a shout out twice to Davenport, once on a housing initiative and then once for some police officers engaged in some heroic actions. Can you kind of close out by discussing both of those?
Yeah, that was kind of the impetus too for us taking a look at not only doing the Back the Blue, but to continue our move for criminal justice reform and the heroic efforts of those three officers. It is truly amazing that they survived the onslaught of attack and the bullets, and the gentleman that was shot was there, and both their spouses were with them too. And I thank them for coming over and giving us the opportunity to just personally say, and for our state, for all of Iowans to personally say to them, you know, thank you for stepping up and keeping our, you know, community safe and protecting people and property, and we appreciate that, and we're going to continue to have your back moving forward. And so we're going to do that while we continue our march towards social justice, and both of them are equally important, and we can do both at the same time. And so, again, the Criminal Justice Reform Committee, the Focus Committee, worked diligently on some issues and made recommendations to the and one of them was to, you know, ban racial profiling, which is already in the Constitution, but it puts it in the statute, and other forms of disparate treatment. And we want to make sure that everybody is treated equally and that we have a safe place, but that I want our law enforcement to know that we continue to have their back. And just the And then back to the housing unit, I think it was 41 units that you were able to do, they were able to do in a downtown district, and it's just an example. I love to give those kinds of examples because it's what other communities can do with some of the existing funding. We just don't have enough of it. And we had three times the request than what we had available, and it works. And those, I think it was 41, were rented in 2 months. So that's incredible. Think about the impact that that brings to the community and to the riverfront and to the, you know, it's a catalyst for small business owners, new business owners, entrepreneurs to really take advantage of the people that that brought to that development. So those are incredible, and we want to highlight that, and we want to see that happening all across the state. So kudos to them for taking advantage of that and providing that kind of growth to their community.
Well, Governor, I want to again thank you. That was a fact and information packed 26 minutes or so, where you got a lot out. You had a lot of initiatives you talked about, and now you're going to be, are your plans to hit the road a little bit, or just work directly with the legislature, or both, to sell these?
Oh, we'll do both. We're working now, so we have a lot of the bills closed. So it's, I think, you know, we've talked about them, but like with anybody, the devil is in the details. So we feel good about them, but you know, letting them see the legislation, see what it looks like, give them the opportunity to ask questions, make suggestions. It'll go through the process, and that's how it's supposed to. So we're going to make sure that we're reaching out to them and available for any questions they might have or suggestions they may have. And again, I think if we can tackle issues like broadband, child care, workforce training, and housing, we really are going to set Iowa on a solid path of economic prosperity for years to come. So I'm excited about it, because I think it really provides opportunities for Iowans and for communities in every single corner of the state, and I am passionate about it happening in every single corner of the state.
Okay, well, thank you again. Governor Kim Reynolds has been our guest today, and I really appreciate you taking the time to share a lot of the details in your condition of the state speech.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. Good to talk to you.
Nice talking to you. Take care.
Bye.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.